You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Road. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, week one results from Zendikar Rising in Modern and Pioneer. Then on the flashback, our testing results with Scourge of the Skyclaves. Finally on the brew session, it's Omnath, Locus of Creation. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 73 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joining you from a steamy Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I am joined by my guy on the left coast, Damon Alexander. Damon, what is popping?
Hey, I don't know if I call it steamy here, but at least it's not smoky. We got a nice breath of fresh air, and now we have some rain, but the air quality has never been better.
Leaving Azerbaijan in the dust.
Oh, yeah.
And joining us from the East Coast is the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Dan Schriever. Dan, what is going on?
Hey, I'm doing well. Yeah, I'm enjoying the last days of summer here in North Carolina. I actually just went and got my North Carolina driver's license. I moved about a month ago, but now it's like official. I don't know what animal or mascot we have here in the state. Is it a...
They didn't make you take the test to get your North Carolina
license. Is it a hurricane or is it a panther or something? They actually did make me take a test. So it was just renewing the driver's license, but they didn't tell me or I didn't care to educate myself that there was going to be like a little knowledge exam when you renewed. So I was like doing the vision test where they say, okay, I read the top line of letters. And then there were all these road signs beneath it. And the guy at the desk was like, okay, now read the signs. And I didn't really understand what he meant. I thought he was asking me to like continue the vision test by describing the signs. So I'm like, well, it's a truck going downhill. Like, the next sign has one arrow pointing up and one arrow pointing down. Apparently that's a divided highway. And I think the guy is just looking at me like this idiot.
Have you ever driven before?
Goddamn Yankees coming down in North Carolina. Don't even know how to drive.
So there were eight signs like that that looked normal. And then the last four signs didn't have any words on them. You just had to identify them by shape. And those I just like totally failed. There's like a five-sided sign. Do you guys know this one?
Like a pentagon?
Yeah, like a pentagon. Pointed head on top. And then, yeah, so what use is that if there's a sign with nothing on it, right? So I'm just like, well, it's got five sides. And the guy's like, sir, that's the only sign that shape on the road. It's a school zone. And I'm like, oh, okay. So yeah, I'm perhaps a danger to myself and others, but I got the license and I also registered to vote in North Carolina. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah, North Carolina, big swing state this year in the United States election.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have early voting starting very, very soon. I think 2 weeks from now. So registering just in the nick of time. I think that the timeline of this year is going to be different from what I guess we're used to in the past for many, many reasons, but logistically especially. You know, we're, 5 weeks away now? But I think now is the time to start, for those of you who live in the U.S. at least, getting your ducks in a row, making sure that A, you're registered, and B, you know what the rules are, the procedures are in your municipality.
And if you'd like to vote in person and not vote on election day, that is often an option. So I live in Minnesota. You can vote in person at almost every site starting now. We actually were one of the four states that started a week ago, which is why both Joe Biden, the Democratic candidate, and President Trump were in northern Minnesota trying to make their last-minute appeals to early voters. And a lot of my friends have already actually voted in person, so they didn't have to worry about if their mail vote was lost or if the U.S. post office is doing anything too sketchy. Yeah, if you just go online and check that out, many states do either have a Dropbox or have an actual physical place where you can hand your ballot to a human being. So you don't need to worry about anything hinky happening if that's something that's concerning you.
Yeah, and Taylor Swift has a wonderful page she prepared with voting resources. We have a link in the show notes. It mostly just links to various pages on vote.org, but we'd recommend reading there. And this election cycle promises to be a very important one for the future of America. And I would highly encourage everybody to do a little bit of research on their own to what that means, ideally from a kind of swath of news sources across the spectrum. Any given one can be a little bit biased in some ways.
I think Damon's being a bit cheeky with a Taylor Swift link, but I'm dead serious. I saw a tweet from, well, I won't name names. It was a well-known Magic personality that was like, "Dear Internet, please stop telling me go register to vote. I'm already registered, obviously." And I'm like, well, that's fine, but I think we need to normalize just being able to say, hey, go make sure you are registered. I think that while it's true that most people who listen to podcasts, who spend a lot of time, you know, reading about Magic Online, that sort of thing, probably most people listening to us right now are already on a similar wavelength in terms of, yeah, I'm definitely going to vote, definitely going to participate. But, you know, it doesn't stop with you. It could be, you know, maybe it's a good time to check in now on your loved ones, check in on your relatives, your parents, make sure that they're up to speed on the deadlines. They're coming up really soon. You don't want to find out in November that your parents just didn't vote because they were planning to do it in person. And then they heard, you know, disturbing things happening on election day and 6-hour lines and God knows what else.
And I will be volunteering as an election judge this year. So if you're in Minneapolis, you better be acting right. I'm going to be dropping the firm hand of the law on anyone who misbehaves or tries to vote an extra time or anything like that. So, but yeah, I mean, if you are a younger person and you are wanting to be more involved, volunteering to be an election judge is actually a very important thing to do. Typically, that job is done by old people, people who have voted in the past. My parents were the classic example. You know, mother's a former librarian, retired, bored, invested in the election process. And we know that with the COVID outbreak that we want to really minimize our exposure for older people to be in situations like that. And we know election places are in gymnasiums. These are indoor places that don't have a lot of ventilation. So if it's something where you can find 4 to 6 hours, I'm doing a 6-hour shift myself. Just wear a face mask. If you're relatively young, the risk should be relatively low. Make sure you grease up those hands every 20 minutes, and then you can take part, feel like you did your civic duty, and you can make sure that everything is above board, and you can sort of see that the system is relatively transparent. You don't have to fear too many dark, ominous signs. You can make sure that everything's counted appropriately, et cetera, et cetera.
Or if you go down the news, if you read the various news sources I've been reading, there's some crazy predictions of some weird, weird stuff happening on election day. So we will see if David's proclamation of how the transparent process that will soon emerge holds up.
Yeah, I mean, I've read that stuff too, Damon, and I share your fear, but I also think it's just important to do our part. So I've also applied to be an election poll worker in North Carolina. We'll see if they accept me. Hopefully there's not a driver's test involved.
This guy does not respect school zones.
Exactly. Exactly. And they're voting in a school. Just cruising at 50 miles an hour. Doing donuts in the parking lot.
So you'll be hearing from us, just a friendly reminder, probably in all the weeks leading up to the election. But this is just the start of that. It is election season. So yeah, I think we'll leave it there for this week. But this is a topic we're going to return to again and again. We'll keep it short at the top. And it's more of a friendly reminder than anyone trying to nag anybody.
So with that out of the way, let's move on to everyone's favorite segment, the housekeeping. We got some new patrons to welcome.
We do. So I would like to give a special shout out to our new patrons, who are Jordan D, Chris B, and Urchin C. Well, that's a little too obvious. Maybe you, Collie, for our Simpsons fans out there. Thank you very much to Jordan, Chris, and Urchin. Welcome to the Patreon. And just a quick reminder, our Patreon is patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. Can you tell them some of the sweet prizes that they are eligible for, Dan, when they sign up at various levels of Patreon?
Yeah, they say, you know, play stupid games, win stupid prizes, but support cool podcasts and win awesome podcast Patreon prizes. Something like that. I'll tell you about it. But actually, we have even bigger news, which is that you can now read all about it on our new website. So this is actually our other sort of big, big thing that I'm really excited to announce. People have asked me before, well, what do you guys do with the Patreon money? And actually, most of it goes towards our editor, who is awesome. Tanner does a great job, very professional. But he's often urged me to like, okay, well, now that you have such a sweet editor, you got your time back. So why don't you like put that towards creating something even better. And so what I have been really aching to work on is a brand new home for Faithless Brewing. So faithlessbrewing.com. This is our sort of official debut. Not faithlessbrewing.podbean.com. That's the site that hosts our podcast episodes, but faithlessbrewing.com. Just straight up brand new site. It's got all kinds of stuff there, starting with our podcast, but we have even more than that. We've got articles, we've got some deck lists, some sweet ones from David, and we have some slick new artwork from Whistler. So I really encourage everyone to go check it out, whether that's right now, you know, this is a podcast, just pause it, go take a look. We'll put a link in the show notes. Or when you're done listening, circle back and check it all out. There's some sweet content up there already. We have an article from Brian Madden, whom you guys heard a few weeks back. About sort of how to keep a healthy outlook on the game with everything going on in 2020. That's weathering the storm, how to stay positive about Magic in 2020. We also have a piece that I wrote about sort of my picks, my top 8 picks for modern build around cards from Zendikar Rising.
Very exciting. And we will be adding features to this website as the weeks go along. So we will keep everyone abreast of that at the top of each show. But yeah, right now the site looks great. Great job, Dan, with the format and everything.
I mean, most of the credit goes to Whistler, who's created some truly spectacular pieces. If anyone follows us on Twitter, we're at FaithlessMTG. If you've seen like the banner that's at the top of our Twitter profile, that's kind of a cafe scene with a lot of little curios and trinkets from Magic's past sort of nestled away in the cafe with our favorite dragon, Niv-Mizzet, sipping on a Faithless brew and reading the brew review. So that's one of the pieces. There's like three more new artwork pieces. Never before seen artwork from Whistler on the website. So definitely go check it out.
I would just also like to emphasize that every article written by Dan is exclusively Dan's opinion. It is not the opinion of the Faithless Brewing podcast.
Except for when I quote you.
I'm not on the hook for any of the top 8 picks is all I want to say. It comes from the considered analysis of one Dr. Daniel Schriever by himself. There was no David Robertson input.
I mean, that's funny because we also have some new deck lists that you made up and you that you created. You brewed them up, sent them to me, and I like couched them in some fancy formatting, did a little write-up there. So you can find David's opinions as well with my editorializing wrapped around it.
There you go. Exactly. The last word. So, all right. Lots of stuff to check out there. Obviously, you can check us out in the Discord. If you are a Patreon member, you can check out the website. There's a bunch of stuff there. So if you need Faithless Brewing in your life, there's many ways to get it. With that said, it is time to dig into week one of the Zendikar Rising. Just at the top, we are not a standard podcast. We don't spend a lot of time playing standard. I think maybe Dan's the only one of us that's even played it in the last 6 to 9 months. We know that there is a big announcement or announcement to be announced. The promise ring to promise to get married eventually. We have no comment on that at this time. So what we're looking at is some technology from Zendikar Rising that made its way into either Pioneer or Modern. So Dan, what's the big headline from week one in your mind?
Yeah, so I guess I'll refer back to my article, the top 8 build arounds from Zendikar Rising for Modern, which you can find at faithlessbrewing.com. Gosh, that website's so hot right now. I almost want to go check it out right now and start reading it. But no, we gotta do this podcast. There, I was kind of thinking about what we had identified during our spoiler episodes as the most likely cards to hit in Modern. And what I had kind of arrived at was, I think, somewhat of a consensus. We liked cards like Cleansing Wildfire. We liked Skyclave Apparition. We liked Omnath. And we liked the double face cards, the spell lands. We also liked Scourge of the Skyclaves, so much so that we featured it last week. And basically all of those cards made an impact in week one, showing up in multiple lists in not just leagues, but also the challenges over the weekend. And also a few cards that I wasn't really paying that much attention to, Ruin Crab in particular and Magmatic Channeler. With those as like the big winners, let's say, let's dive into some of the lists. We obviously are going to talk more about Scourge of the Skyclaves in our flashback segment. That's the card we tested. So we'll hold off on that. And Omnath is our card for this week. So we'll also sort of postpone that discussion until the brew session on this show. But Damon, why don't we jump in with this mill strategy? What's going on with Ruin Crab?
Okay, so the mill archetype got a couple of major upgrades from Zendikar Rising, namely Rune Crab, which is just Hedron Crabs 5 through 8, and Maddening Cacophony, which is a slightly worse Glimpse the Unthinkable in the straight-up mode, 1 and a blue to mill 8 versus blue-black to mill 10, but first off can be kicked for 7 mana to mill half the opponent's library, although whenever I see this come up, usually the opponent's library is less than 16 cards. And also notably, Gets Around Veil of Summer, because it says each opponent versus target opponent, whereas Glimpse of the Unthinkable can go the one green cryptic command way of sadness. And so this list is, this mill archetype has been doing really well. I've also been seeing people trying out blue-white mill instead of blue-black mill. And so it went from being this kind of tier 2 to tier 2.5 deck that we actually played a few leagues back in Vantress Gargoyle weeks into perhaps a new tier 1 archetype in Modern. The question, of course, is, well, what could we do to get around it? I've personally been a fan of Nexus of Fate, but nobody really knows yet. Is Nexus of Fate better than playing one of the Eldrazi Titans that shuffles your whole graveyard back in? Or is Nexus better because it can't be surgical in response? And if they mill you down to just Nexus and you have 7 lands in play and can make forward progress, you have infinite turns and win the game.
So can you just run through those options one last time? So you're saying Nexus does not expose itself to surgical because it's not a trigger?
Right. Nexus is a replacement effect. It doesn't go to your graveyard. It gets shuffled right back in. Whereas, for example, a Kozilek or Emrakul hit the graveyard, cause a trigger to shuffle your whole graveyard in. But in the meantime, the opponent can surgical your Eldrazi Titan, and then you just get this kind of one-shot shuffle versus Nexus of Fate, which just kind of never leaves your library unless it gets stuck in your hand somehow.
And it could get stuck there if you didn't have enough mana to cast it, let's say.
Right, right.
Or you'd find yourself basically forced to cast it every turn so you don't deck out, and you might actually have anything left to actually win the game from there. So I'm not sure that I would immediately go to Nexus.
Yeah. I think I would start with Nexus in decks that have the ways to slow down the game. So, for example, in a control deck like Blue Moon, you can counter, a Glimpse of the Unthinkable. You can bolt a Hedron Crab. You can abrade a Mesmeric Orb. You know, some of this stuff's going to resolve. You're going to get milled somewhat, no doubt. But you can slow the game down until you maybe have 7 lands in play. And along the way, you know, they're going to be some percent of their mills get wasted on the Nexus of Fate. And so it slows it down some nominal amount along the way.
I think it's just important to note that Rune Crab is actually a little better than Hedron Crab, specifically in the mill deck. It does not target, so a lot of people are bringing in various ways that prevent you from being targeted. So Rune Crab gets around that. And it is an 0-3. It does come up sometimes at extra point of toughness, lets it block, I don't know, Dark Confidant, Snapcaster Mage, etc. without dying.
Yeah.
And some of the black decks are playing Bloodsheath's Thirst. This was a card that Dan liked, so it's sort of Fatal Push 5 through 8, and matchups where that's important. And I think Prowess is everywhere. In some form or another, super aggressive decks, monster, Swiftspear decks, whatever you want to call them. And then it does still give you outs to kill planeswalkers if that becomes a thing.
Yeah, and I think that non-targeting clause is actually more important than I initially realized. People are actually eschewing the Glimpse the Unthinkable, which is 10 cards, and just going for Cacophony, 2 cards fewer, just to avoid potential, not just for Veil of Summer, but even for, I don't know, if people bring in Leyline of Sanctity, for example. Now you have both the Ruin Crab and the Mesmeric Orb and the Madden Cacophony that all get around that. So just the available angles for interacting with mill are simultaneously closed down while the deck just gets faster and more consistent. I think every list had 8 crabs. Some were going even further with Manic Scribe. So yeah, I almost think we do need to, just like Damon suggested, go through our counterplay options. I've seen Gaia's Blessing suggested.
I mean, I think Gaia's Blessing is the best option if you aren't playing blue. I think it's much better than an Eldrazi if you have green. If you draw, you can actually still cast it. If you have 2 of them, you can create your loop. And so if you want to just always beat mill, you can just put 2 in your sideboard and you probably won't ever lose to mill.
Well, they play surgicals, right? They can surgical the first Gaia's Blessing and then your plan. They basically have to mill a lot more cards.
Yeah, but I mean, their clock is actually relatively slow. So the first time that they, you know, get your blessing, if they don't also have like the black trap, then I think you're pretty safe.
Yeah, I think it depends on your type of deck, in the sense that I find the mill deck starts off slow and then builds up steam, because over time you accumulate more crabs in play. And meanwhile, you have more time. For example, maybe you have an archive trap you didn't manage to get off early, but by the 5th turn, you can just hard cast it. Meanwhile, Visions of Beyond goes from a really bad cantrip into Ancestral Recall, and that's really where they pick up the steam. Maybe by turn 7, they're kicking their Maddening Cacophonies. And so I'm not sure that buying a little bit of time versus mill is super – how much it helps.
I mean, I've seen it just be backbreaking in the games I've seen. I actually think mill can not be tier 1 ever, other than if you say it's at a tier where I need to dedicate a spot or 2 to my sideboard to beat it.
That's certainly possible, yeah. I think the question now is just, what is the right card? Is it Gaia's Blessing? Is it Nexus of Fate? Is it Eldrazi? Is it something different?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think that if I'm going to dedicate a slot to beating a mill, I definitely want to make sure the card always works. So for that reason alone, I'm more inclined to at least put the blessing in, just so that, like, I don't draw the Ula Mulligan and have it get stuck in my hand or something. That would be really embarrassing. Gaia's Blessing, even if it's just one copy, you can cast it and then Mystic Sanctuary it back in response to the mill card so that you get that automatic trigger.
I mean, you don't have to play green is the thing, though. So maybe the Eldrazi is better if you're not playing green or blue for the other one.
Yeah, I've heard Wheel of Sun and Moon is also pretty good.
Little Niv-Mizzet hit.
Oh, yeah. Not good versus Hogak.
It turns out, yeah.
We tried.
Hogak Summer was was a different animal.
All right, so that's Mill. Let's talk about the double-faced cards, and specifically all the double-faced cards, or rather a deck with all double-faced cards and no lands. So this is something that we kind of theorized as, a fun thought experiment, but people actually have done it. You know, modern players being what they are will find the shortest route to play the least Magic possible on opening day. So this is kind of the talk of the Magic sphere for about 48 hours. David, do you want to take us through how this deck works?
Yeah, so the first Major 5-0 was posted by Sebastian Stuckel. Basically, what the deck does is it has no lands in it, and so it's trying to find a way to turbo out a Goblin Charbelcher. Goblin Charbelcher is a 4-mana artifact, and it reads 3-mana tap, reveal cards from the top of your library until you reveal a land card, and it deals damage equal to the number of revealed cards to any target. So functionally what happens is once you get Goblin Charbelcher down and you tap 3-mana and activate it, there's no lands left in your deck. So you just reveal all the cards in your library and you do that much damage to your opponent. So if you have, you know, more than their life total left in cards in your library, you kill them. The deck takes advantage of the fact that they can play actually a ton of land sources. Other than ramp spells, the deck is actually all lands and then rituals. Manamorphose is not technically a ritual. And he made a bunch of really other cool choices. One of them is Recross the Paths. This is a card I didn't even know existed, but it reads reveal cards from the top of your library until you reveal a land card. So we know in this deck we won't ever reveal one. And then you end up getting to basically stack your library. And to take advantage of that, he has one Reforge the Soul, which allows him to flip into whatever 7 cards he wants on his next draw. And often that's just a bunch of mana and Goblin Charbelcher. So, you know, he can reveal Simeon, or the 7 cards he draws could be like Simeon Spirit Guide, you know, a bunch of rituals and Goblin Charbelcher. Yeah, this deck is actually super sweet. The generic lists that have been proposed were pretty blah. This deck has the ability to kill on turn 2. It has that super cool, like, Recross the Paths angle. He understood the ways to interact with their pre-limited, so he was main decking for Veil of Summer. So, yeah, I mean, I don't like that this type of deck exists, but I think the actual design of this deck is super cool. Like, this is an actual sweet brew as opposed to a lot of these other lists are basically just adding like the 4 obvious cards to the shell that we thought it would go in. This is a specific shell that I didn't hear anyone talking about.
Yeah, you get the feeling that the Recross the Paths interaction with the MDFCs is not something the play design had on the radar. What's crazy is that you can basically stack your deck, and then from there, if they have a Leyland of Sanctity so you can't belch them, you can put a Wilt as part of your 7 cards, or you can put, I noticed there's a Bushwhacker and Empty the Warrens, so you can attack through combat damage if they have something else that's stopping the belching plan, like a Collector Oof. And so the deck, in this sense, becomes very versatile through the Recross the Paths, letting you find your sideboard cards. But I agree with David, this deck is also not a whole lot of fun to play against. There's just not a whole lot of magic involved.
It's also worth noting the first list. So Dan has a list posted here from the Modern Challenge. The list that he first posted the 5-0 with had a separate angle, which wasn't Goblin Bushwhacker, Empty the Warrens. It was Collected Company, with ways to go through your whole deck and then win with the 1-3, which you could do again. So he just has a bunch of different cool ways to win. He is playing 4 Leyland of Sanctity in his sideboard. I think that is a nod to Mill.
Well, it's not to Mill, Belcher, discard spells. It stops a lot of stuff this deck cares about.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, just super cool deck. It's not my style of deck, but it's certainly like, I think it was obvious there'd be some kind of oops all spell shell. There's actually been a couple listed of 5-0 in Pioneer as well. But this is still like one of the coolest sort of like actually out there brews. People were not talking about Recross the Paths, setting up your hand, etc., and winning the game. That's not a card that was on anyone's radar. So
Yeah, if you've played a lot of like the tournament practice room over the past year, you occasionally run into these 7-land mono green Belcher decks where they couldn't really win for sure until they had fetched 3 or 4 forests out of their deck. And they played Recross the Paths for that. So I was used to seeing that card, but it didn't really occur to me that, I don't know why they did this, but the card says after you reveal the cards, put them back in any order. Maybe because they just didn't want to tell you to shuffle them. But having that function as like this doomsday-like effect is A, super cool, B, super scary. Like imagine trying to resolve this on paper. It's like a scry 50. And then C, it opens up those sideboard lines like you were talking about. Whoever thought of putting Reforge a Soul as the thing you put on top after Recross the Paths, we'll buy them a beer because that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I think when this deck kind of first appeared, people were really worried about it. It does have a little Neo brand sense to it where you're not playing a lot of like Magic as Richard Garfield intended. And people were having a lot of success with it. But I think there are enough avenues to attack it that I think it started to show some cracks. And you can see only went 4-2 at the challenge. That's not the most dominating showing. And I think it's already kind of like fading. And maybe in the same way that Mill is, where if you're not prepared for it, these decks are incredibly hard to beat. But if you're willing to make some adjustments and you think about how to attack them, there is avenues where you can make progress.
Yeah, David, you suggested the card Mind Grind as a way to beat these decks if they ever take over the metagame. And I thought you meant Mind Funeral at first, and I was like, well, what's the point of that? That just gets Veil of Summered. But it turns out Mind Grind doesn't target. It's a blue-black X. Each opponent reveals cards until they reveal X lands, and they mill the rest. So.
And you can see that he actually has a basic land in his sideboard. Now, I think that's to try to fight off Wildfire.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as a way to delay the like the crucial turn when they get their artifact out. But so you at least have a land to fetch. That's even cool technology. And I think that I've seen people beat them by just blow up a land on turn 2, blow up a land on turn 3, or Ghost Core them. You just have to delay them a little bit. And all of a sudden, you know, they're not playing any interaction. So your 2-2 or 3-3 is just getting in there every turn. And you're just trying to stop them from getting 7 mana total spent on their Belcher.
So yeah, I tried to Cleansing Wildfire them on turn 2 on the play after losing game 1 on turn 3. And they go, okay, well, going into turn 2 with no lands in play, they go land, SSG, ritual, 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 Ironcrag Feet, Belcher. And made me wonder if Mind Grind is too slow.
You kind of play around that, Damon. Come on, it's just basic Magic.
I know, I had a chance to. I went for the line because I was like, well, this buys me a turn. I can start getting my clock on. And I had a different line available involving the Thoughtseize. It's like, well, clearly going off from 0 lands, I don't know, on turn 2. But you got a Thoughtseize then.
So much for Char Belcher. Let's move on to a much, much, much fairer card. Skyclave Apparition. This is the 1-white-white spirit, the 2-2. When it enters, you get to exile a non-land permanent CMC 4 or less that the opponent controls. When it leaves the battlefield, they don't get their permanent back. That's still gone forever, but they do get an illusion token. So this is one that's, you know, I think we... Well, David, I think you said this was the perfect card for white, and I was not as convinced, but I've come around on it, and it looks like everyone who has ever picked up a tier 2, tier 2.5 white base midrange deck just like came out of the floorboards, came out of the woodwork here and like registered for a modern league. So there's all kinds of white midrange decks showing up in the 5-0s and challenges.
Yeah, it turns out that getting back an XX between a 1-1 and a 4-4 is typically a lot worse than the average card played in modern decks that they're casting that this card is exiling to begin with. And so unlike Deputy of Detention or Fairground Warden, which the opponent kills, gets back their creature, gets back their ETB, and has something like a, you know, a big Tarmogoyf, now they just give back a 2-2. So in essence, this is a very meaningful upgrade to those sorts of cards. Of course, it can't hit bigger things like Primeval Titan or Ugin's, but Spirit's decks are probably already, you know, losing the game at that point.
Yeah, I mean, this card just does everything. It's templated the way old people like us like to take advantage of Ephemerate. It gets rid of Uro permanently, which is something that white was lacking. It actually gets rid of Planeswalkers permanently. You know, one of the things that happens sometimes is you deputy a detention their Jace. Eventually they draw their Bolt. You know, they bolt your guy EOT so you didn't get to attack their Jace. And they basically get to untap with Jace and do their worst. And you lose those games. So, you know, getting back a 4-4, especially against a lot of these decks, it's even great against mill. You know, it doesn't matter at all if they're trying to mill you out. Them killing your guy and getting back a 1-1. So against every deck that isn't actually trying to use the attack step, the Leaf's play trigger basically does nothing. all of the Leafs play triggers are illusions. So if you're playing like three of these and one deputy, if you're blinking all their permanents and you just like tutor up your deputy and get it, you get all those illusions at one time and they never come back. It just does, it does a bunch of stuff for a bunch of different decks. It's main deck removal. You don't have to play Path anymore, which I think is kind of a bad card right now because there's all these ramp decks that want to get a bunch of lands in play because they want to trigger Field of the Dead. So yeah, I mean, I thought this was good, and I think it's actually been much better than even I thought it was going to be, to be fair. The card is just great, and it makes a lot of these fair decks better. And this effect, which I think Brian Braun-Duin had said White should be focusing on like a year and a half ago, this replacement effect where you don't get the creature back is just really subtly powerful in a way that isn't obvious.
Yeah, Baffling End has always impressed me.
So I said it was showing up in a lot of decks. What did I mean by that? Let's just run down the list. So Spirits, first of all, yes, Blue-White Spirits took second place in the Sunday Challenge by Danny M. Rebel. Also Banned Spirits in the 5-0s by someone named Dr. Queller. Death and Taxes, a bunch of different Death and Taxes variants. I see a 5-0 from Spider Space, a noted Death and Taxes player. Also two others by Metcalf and Sin for Life. Stoneblade decks. So the Taxes decks are Stoneforge Mystic decks, but there's also a slick-looking black-white Stoneblade list that 5-0'd. And then if we're looking more into the creature toolbox, we see some people turning towards Skyclave Apparition as their one of. So there's a Naya Kikikord deck that top 32'd the Sunday Challenge by Kurusu, where, you know, you might normally expect you'd want to have a Deputy of Detention as a tutor target. Well, this deck wasn't actually playing blue, so I'm actually not sure which one is better, Apparition or Deputy, if you just only wanted to play one. But if you're not playing blue, you're thrilled to have access to this effect now, just in the Naya colors. There's even a green-white Restoration Angel deck. I think it's kind of like a Hate Bears-esque strategy. This is one after David's Heart.
I think as soon as your deck starts playing cards like Restoration Angel and Urien, that's where this becomes meaningfully better than Deputy Detention.
And especially the card Ephemerate. I just cannot emphasize like how powerful this is with Ephemerate. And we'll talk about it later, but I think this is like a super sweet time to start playing Soul Rider again. The lands mattering a lot, blowing them up with our favorite 2-2 Haste. This being a removal spell that you can cord for. If you're already playing 4 Ephemerate, some amount of Restoration Angels in your Urien, like Damon's saying. The card's just like a jillion for one, and if you have a one of detention, deputy detention to 2-4 at the end, it just cleans everything up after all that nonsense. So, or they kill it to get their 3-3, then you like e-witness it back, and you're just up material. The fact that it actually exiles is good against Uro decks, even if you don't get Uro specifically, because all the other creatures aren't going to the graveyard, or the planeswalkers, etc.
Yeah, that's sweet. So I'm really impressed both by what the card can do, and just like how people are embracing it, how people are using it. I didn't even finish reading the list. There's an Abzan Aether Vial Flicker Collected Company deck by Antoine 57437. This player has been playing the same archetype for like almost 2.5 years now. So shout out to them for just grinding and grinding with it. And there's even like a mono white Heliod combo that had 4 copies of Luminarch Aspirant. This is the new one. It's a 1/1 for 2, and it lets you place a +1/+1 counter on a creature of your choice when you go to your combat step. I was really surprised to see that here. It's a 4-of in the list, and it's not really a beatdown deck, so I was trying to figure out why you would even consider this, and it turns out they're just using it to speed up the Heliod combo, which is something, David, you talked about as a possibility that we thought was just moot because, you know, Pioneer Ballista's banned, but it turns out it's good enough for Modern, at least for this one league. So really cool to see the Apparition finding so many homes, and I think this is perhaps giving us an excuse to revisit our creature-based white decks that we are so fond of. That being said, let's move on to Cleansing Wildfire.
Yeah, so Cleansing Wildfire is a card we targeted as like pretty cool. It's actually more powerful than a card that they printed in Modern Horizons, which is obviously a mistake that they'll fire someone for. So 1 red sorcery, destroy target land. Its controller may search their library for a basic land card, put it onto the battlefield tap, then shuffle their library, draw a card. So it compares in some ways to a card like Spreading Seas. It's a 2-mana card that cycles. It disrupts mana, but it doesn't necessarily eliminate mana. I think the first use everybody had in mind is just this is a play that actually disrupts Tron on the draw. So all these other cards don't. If you have Pillage or whatever, you can have all kinds of those effects that you want. When Tron is on the play, if they assemble Tron on turn 3, they get that one turn to play Karn or Worm Coil or whatever. It doesn't matter how many pillages you have in your hand, unless you're playing like an Arbor Elf or something else, they're going to get to do that. So sideboard for decks like Jund that aren't playing Mana Acceleration, this is just a huge upgrade. It disrupts on turn two. It cycles. It's never dead. I think that's its primary use. It has a few other corner case uses. People are trying to do a little bit of combo-y stuff. If you have a 3-mana Teferi and cast it in their upkeep, it actually costs them a mana for the turn because the basic land comes into play tapped. And you can target indestructible lands, etc., to make it a 2-mana rampant growth that also cycles. Yeah, it does a lot of things. I think its main use is a sideboard card to disrupt big mana. And I'm really glad to see that. I don't like Tron, and so anything that messes with Tron has got to be pretty good in my book.
Yeah, I think most of the results that have been posted use it as, you know, 2 or 3 copies in the sideboard so far. There was one Jeskai deck that played a full playset in the main deck in where we might otherwise normally see a Spreading Seas in that slot, possibly because it's just better than Spreading Seas. That's not totally clear, but if you have the option to snap it back with Snapcaster or continue to pressure them with Field of Ruins, then it gets a little more attractive to cast like multiple Wildfires throughout the course of a game, whereas you can only Spreading Seas once.
Well, and these Jeskai lists are also playing, they're bending their mana. So they're playing 4 Flagstones of Trocaire. So some amount of the time, it is just a straight up ramp spell. So it can be Spreading Seas to disrupt your opponent. It can also be a ramp spell early for you, and then later you can flash it back if you want to blow up their Field of the Dead, etc. I know Aspiring Spike, who guested on this podcast, he's been loving it in his lists. I see the list that people are playing is basically his list plus or minus a couple cards. So I'm not saying anyone is, I don't know who the specific originator is, but he's been streaming a lot of that this week and has been liking it quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what else we can do with pointing the Wildfire at our own lands. David, you've drawn up a pretty sweet list. We've posted it on our website, actually, faithlessbrewing.com. Go check that out. It's like a red-white, I don't know, it's like a boom bust deck. Is that how you describe it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it uses boom bust, which targets one of your lands and one of their lands and destroys both. So that card already incentivizes you to play both Flagstones and like Cascading Cataracts, indestructible land. Cleansing Wildfire gives you 4 more of that effect. So if you're curious to see what a possible home like that might look like, David has a nice list drawn up, which is posted on our site. Moving on, but still within the color red and still at the 2-mana, 1 and a red casting cost, we have Magmatic Channeler. This is a card that I kind of poo-pooed. Like, I didn't think he was going to amount to anything, but I gotta eat my words because it's showed up in a bunch of different places, even in Modern, 3 different archetypes. So Damon, do you want to tell us about some of these homes?
So the first one is an Is It Delver list coming from Tubby Batman, who I think we've discussed some of their lists before. And it runs this basically in the role that you'd expect to see Dreadhorde Arcanist. And so we've said many times where we have been let down by Dreadhorde Arcanist a million times in Modern, even though the card is a legacy powerhouse. And Magmatic Channeler seems to just kind of work better. It can close the game out when it becomes a 4-4. And meanwhile, it kind of can play a similar game when it comes to synergizing with certain cards with discard interactions. Or just simply cycling through your deck to find the spells you need if you flood out or whatever.
Yeah, I guess I would call this like a blue-red wizard list almost. 4 Delver of Secrets, 4 Soulscar Mage, 4 Channeler, that's a wizard, 3 Snapcaster. And then it's got both Wizard's Lightning and Wizard's Retort, so 8 of the wizard tribal cards. I still don't totally buy the Channeler here, but maybe I just have to like try it. I don't know. Is this the kind of shell you were envisioning, David?
I wasn't actually thinking this card would be that good in Modern because Lightning Bolt is just a thing that you can do, and maybe you should be doing. Prowess is everywhere, and even the shell around the Prowess creatures changes. You can play blue, you can play black, you can play Shadow, you can play Scourge of the Skyclave, as we'll talk about in a second here. The one card that's in every list is Lightning Bolt. So I'm actually surprised to see it do this well in Modern. I think as a Pioneer card, it's just awesome. I've got a bunch of different shells that I'm excited to try out in that format. But here, I mean, yeah, it's just an awesome card. It's way better than Arcanist. I mean, I said that when it was spoiled, and it's just not even close. If you're not flashing back some like Brainstorm or something, then it's just no comparison. And I don't think it's a surprise that if they're forced to kill your Prowess creatures early, then this is a card that's just going to accrue a ton of value.
Yeah, and you can always wait to play it as a 4-4 against Lightning Bolt decks.
Yeah.
So like a 2-mana 4/4 and blue red is just, which can play a pretty good tempo game, is potentially quite strong. I mean, as this result shows, what surprises me, I guess, is that there's really no cards that it seems truly synergized with the discarded card clause, like, or the cast from exile clause. So, you know, cards like See the Truth or Fiery Temper, we don't see any of those. And maybe that's just too cute. Chandler's all business.
I think those cards are Pioneer level. I think if you made a deck, you'd have some number of those in your Pioneer deck. But the base of power for cards is like, you're hoping that you get to cast your Madness Spell as a Lightning Bolt, and this deck can just play 8 Lightning Bolts. It doesn't need to like do that. I do think, though, that like cards are really powerful in certain matchups. So, you know, you need to play your Force of Negations and Disrupting Shoal so you don't lose to some of these combo decks. Well, against decks where that's not good, against humans or something, it functionally is just like, discard your Force of Negation, which wasn't doing anything, and turn it into like 2 looks at exactly the card you need to win the game. And then eventually it just becomes a beater that blocks their, you know, Meddling Mage or Reflector Mage or whatever else. So it can wear a lot of hats, and cards that are modal, like we talk about, just tend to be more powerful than we realize. The fact that it can even in a pinch, if you really needed to, just pitch a card and like desperately search for a counterspell is also sweet.
Yeah, I'm not excited about having to do that. I almost was expecting it to be more used in a proactive, like burn heavy deck, so that at least when you activate it, you have most of your cards are going to be hits. If you're discarding one and getting 2 looks at cards you can cast, it's almost like you looted twice in the same turn. You just like drew 2 and discarded one of those. So that would be pretty cool. And actually, we did see a list from M. Hayashi, 2 5-0s with the same basic shell. So David, you want to tell us about this? I guess he's calling it alternative prowess.
Yeah, so M. Hayashi has been, I believe, the progenitor, if I'm wrong, somebody will hopefully please correct me, of the sort of mono red, but he was playing the 5-mana companion that forces you to play all odd cards. Of course, I'm forgetting its name.
Obosh.
Obosh, the Prey Piercer. And in this deck, he's basically giving it up just to play Magmatic Chandler. That's how much he likes it. In addition, he's adding Shatter Skull, the red Bolt Land, which is a card we did talk about having applications in prowess, because the fail case of just red, like add 2 power to the board is at least something. And so the Chandler, again, there's a bunch of cards here that have flashbacks. So you could say it has some soft synergies, but it's just a great card. And so it's a deck that's it's hard to describe. It's playing a bunch of what we would consider to generically be not that powerful burn spells. We're talking about Firebolt. We're talking about Fire Slash. It's playing the normal 8 suite of 1-drops. It's playing 4 Bonecrusher Giant, 4 Light Up the Stage, 4 Seasoned Pyromancer. A lot of these cards are actually just great in the mirror. Flame Slash is great mirror breaker technology. Bonecrusher Giant has historically been good as a way to go a little bit bigger than aggro red decks. I've seen this deck in action. I did not think it was very good. I didn't think the Obosh version could possibly be as good as like the red-black prowess, and it just crushes the mirror. And he must like specifically what Magmatic Chandler is bringing to the equation, because he actually changed his whole sideboard and everything else just to play that, basically. Maybe once he decided to play the Bolt Land, he was just looking for the best 2-mana card. Not playing Manamorphos, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, Hayashi on Twitter claims that Chandler is amazing, actually. It's like a mini Goyf with a repeatable Abbot ability when it sticks, which if it comes down as a 4-4, isn't actually extremely unlikely given it's out of Bolt range. It's a strong statement in favor of Chandler.
I still don't quite understand why Firebolt and Flame Slash are the cards of choice. Like, why not Burst Lightning? But I guess M. Hayashi knows what they're doing. The full four copies of Shatter Skull Smashing is also somewhat alarming and surprising, but it actually does, in addition to triggering prowess, gives you more ways to discard sorceries, whether you're discarding it to Seasoned Pyromancer or to a Magmatic Channeler, and then you can get to that potentially +3/+1 bonus on the Channeler faster by having these extra free sorceries in the deck.
Yeah, like hiding a sorcery as hiding a land as one of your sorceries, like, really matters for Seasoned Pyromancer. Like, getting a free 1/1 some percentage of the time is a lot. I mean, you know, normally you're like, well, I might as well just play out all my lands. Sometimes the 1/1's better. So, I mean, that's going to actually matter a surprising amount every time it blocks a 7/7 Death Shadow.
Every time your opponent's Goblin Guide trigger hits your Shatter Skull, smashing.
Yeah, and if those 2 homes were not already good enough, maybe the best finish for Magmatic Channeler was actually a top 8 list from the Modern Challenge. Totally different strategy, just Traverse Shadow. I think it was a 4-color Traverse Shadow, where typically you might expect to see certain creatures tried as one of. So there's like a one of Scourge of the Skyclaves here to search for. But there's actually two copies of Magmatic Channeler. So I guess Bench Summer is the player liked the Channeler twice as much as they liked the Scourge and played two full copies in this Traverse Shadow deck.
And I think one of those things this does is you want to play a lot of hand disruption in your deck because you want to protect your creatures. And you guys can, I think, speak to that when we get to our Scourge discussion later. But it sucks to draw Inquisition of Kozilek on turn 7, right? Now Magmatic Channeler turns that into two looks at finding a shadow. So late in the game, all you want to find is shadows. The rest of your deck isn't actually that good. Early in the game, it's just another creature that they have to spend a removal spell on without a coming to play ability, which is all the creatures that are in this deck.
Yeah, I would almost expect to see a Seasoned Pyromancer in that role. And I thought maybe they were not playing Seasoned Pyromancer because they wanted Lurrus, but they're not playing Lurrus either. They are going with Street Race. They're going with Goreclan Rampager. So it's an interesting build. Can't argue with results. It got, in addition to the challenge top 8, the same player 4-1 to prelim. And another player, Wu-Tang, took the same list to a 5-0 league. So it seems to be a good home, or at least a good deck, which can make use of the Channeler. So those are what I would call the big winners. And obviously, we're going to come back to Scourge and Uro in just a bit. There's also a bunch of cards. We can call them small winners, or maybe the jury is still out. So specifically, just real quick, the Mythic Bolt lands, apart from the Charbelcher deck, are seeing small quantities of play. We just talked about the Shadow Skull Smashing and what that can do for a Red Prowess deck, but Turn Timber Symbiosis is seeing a lot of play, specifically in Titan decks, but also even one of in the Hardened Scales list that won the Sunday Challenge. I'm kind of surprised to see that there.
I mean, you keep calling these lists Hardened Scales. They're Heliod Spike Feeder decks that happen to have Hardened Scales in them.
That's true. Yeah, I guess Hardened Scales doesn't necessarily mean what it used to mean. Yeah, so it's a Conclave Mentor Infinite Life combo that will eventually Ballista kill them. So do you think this is worth it to play like this potential 7 drop here?
Well, I think because you have a bunch of cards, the thing to remember is you both Heliod and Spike Feeder are part of your combo, but finding Ranger Captain of Eos, which then finds Walking Ballista, just gives you a bunch of different hits. And because you actually put the enter with +1/+1 counters, it actually can find Ballista in a way that Collected Company cannot. So that's actually kind of a cool interaction. The Collected Company comes with enough +1/+1 counters that next turn you just give it lifelink. And it's, I think it's just kind of free to do that. If you're going to play 20 lands anyway, or a lot of the times with these decks you're playing, you know, you have your Arbor Elf, you have your Utopia Sprawl, how many lands you want to play. You don't want to cut down too far, but this is like a way to kind of cheat without getting flooded. And because you have like Arbor Elf, Utopia Sprawl, sometimes you get crazy amounts of mana, you know, with they added a path here. Spike Feeder or something, and you find yourself with 7, it just doesn't seem that unreasonable.
Yeah, I mean, 28 or 29 mana sources in a Scales-ish or Heliod deck seems like a ton, but I guess Turn Timber Symbiosis lets you get away with that.
Yeah, and it's just a one of. I think we're seeing a lot of decks experimenting with a single copy. You know, I've seen a lot of one of Agadeem's Awakenings. The Omnath decks seem to be playing one of the blue one, the Seagate Restoration. So those are nice additions to the format. I think only the Amulet Titan decks are playing like a bunch of copies of Turn Timber Symbiosis. So I think that's to be expected. Blood Chief Thirst, David mentioned seeing small play. I think the jury is still out on that one. You know, some mill decks are playing it. I think I saw Jundlis playing it. Unclear, like if that is competing with Fatal Push or which one is better. We'll have to see on that. And we should also probably talk about Akum Hellhound. This is the landfall creature. So this is one that's on the one hand, is additional copies of Steplinks if you want to do landfall. But it's also potentially just a red aggro creature. If you wanted to just deal damage with red creatures, you can now choose not just from your prowess creatures and your goblin guy, but also Akum Hellhound is in the mix. The player Hotbred decided to just go the straight landfall route. So almost like a landfall deck with a combo finish in the form of Escape Shift. So if you can just Escape Shift and sacrifice 4 lands, that's a bunch of landfall triggers to potentially deal lethal with your Steplinkses or Akum Hellhounds or Brushfire Elementals.
Gosh, if you sack 4 flags on a Trocare, you only really need 1 creature.
There we go.
I guess it's hard to have 4 of those in play at the same time, so never mind. Oh, no, you skip shift into 4 flagstones.
Yep, exactly.
That's what I meant to say the first time, obviously.
So just rounding things out, I think I saw a cool equipment deck that was running the new Nahiri and the new Akiri. These are cards that care about equipment. And some of these lists were actually playing Maul of the Skyclaves, 3 mana, +2/+2, and I think he gives flying, is that right?
Flying and first strike.
And first strike. Equips when it comes into play. So that saw a play in a couple different Stoneforge lists. And also Archon of Emeria, this sort of boring, slow, three mana hate bear, got picked up by a bunch of these white mid-range lists, usually two copies. That's the 2/3 flyer that has the Thalia Heretic Cathar text forcing their non-basics to come into play tapped. And it also has the Eidolon of Rhetoric text, only one spell per turn. So it kind of does a little bit of both. It's less good at surviving Lightning Bolt specifically, but against the field, it does a little bit more than, say, either of those other cards do, and it has slightly better combat stats. So all things told, I would say this is a very successful week one for Zendikar Rising, for Modern at least. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, for all our discussion of, you know, is this set too weak in power compared to prior sets, it seems like it's really clicking with Modern with all these cards. A lot of them are minor upgrades to, or perhaps moderate upgrades to tier two decks that can make them have consistency that has them help approach tier one versus cards that are making the tier one decks kind of extra overpowered, with the possible exception of Omnath. We have plenty more to say on that topic.
Yeah, I think I come down the same place as Damon. I don't know if a lot of these cards will actually stick. I do think people like to try out new cards. You know, it's not obvious if they're better or worse. And obviously in different metagames, they'll be, you know, better or worse. But yeah, there's lots of cool cards that are not obviously overpowered, but they find their niche. And improving, you know, tier three decks to tier two is something that anytime a set does that, that's a success. Anytime you make a tier one deck overpowered, that's a failure, as I would define it at least. So we haven't seen that yet with the possible thing of Omnath, but Omnath is not the real culprit there, in my opinion. So I'm actually kind of fine with it.
So all that is Modern. Very exciting. Everything's happening in Modern. It's a party. Briefly in Pioneer. Damon, what's going on in Pioneer right now?
Not much. Nobody's playing Pioneer. But in short, there's a lot of pathways. Pathways are a meaningful upgrade to most Pioneer mana bases. Winota gets to play Lotus Cobra now. Lawson Zandy has had success with that. He got a 5-0 pretty quickly. Niv decks can now play Omnath, and Spirits can play a couple of Glasspool Mimics, and Bloodsheath Thirst goes in some mono black lists. Again, I think the jury's out compared to Fatal Push. But we're not really seeing the level of innovation and trying out different things that we saw in Modern. And it's hard to say if that's because these cards don't slot into Pioneer well because they just don't have the right supporting architecture, or if it's just nobody's really playing Pioneer.
Yeah, I was briefly in a Pioneer queue, and there were like 112 people in the queue. I think that number did get up to around like 160 by the end of this week, but that's still a very alarming number. That was almost like the nadir of the pre-ban when they decided to try to resuscitate the format. It briefly was up in the 400s, and so it's a little concerning. I'm hoping it can start picking up steam again, but it may be that WotC is just on irreparable harm to it. It may be that the format was always going to be sort of fundamentally flawed. Maybe it was always meant to be a paper format, and that's no one's fault that COVID's happening now. It's hard to sort of diagnose the issues with Pioneer.
Yeah, or maybe just like in the new week, people prefer to start out trying out new brews and old favorite lists with a couple new tweaks in Modern.
And I mean, Landfall, it does maybe lend itself to the fetch land format as possible. And I mean, they already broke Standard in like 3 days, so maybe that took a lot of collective mental energy from the Magic Plane public.
Yeah, I mean, seeing the screenshots of what the Standard decks are doing, I start to wonder, can you build the same thing in Pioneer? I mean, if in Standard having turn four with 18 lands, 5,000 creatures, 20 cards in hand, and 50 life is good, you know, those board states tend to be in your favor in Pioneer too.
Yeah, and we're going to get to some lists that are doing exactly that. Some of these Omnath lists in Pioneer, they almost look like Standard lists when you first glance at them. And you're like, wait, oh, there's Agent of Treachery in there. Otherwise, it just looks like a Standard deck. It's just really, really powerful, that axis, in Standard at least. And as we've seen, that often can translate to Pioneer, often. So I think it is too early to say in Pioneer specifically, just because the numbers are a little bit too low right now. I wouldn't panic just yet. Everything resets whenever the new set releases, so all the leagues reset to zero players, and then it takes time for the number to get back up. So we'll see. I don't think there's anything sort of fundamentally broken about the format right now. It's just like people are distracted. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of good formats to choose from. Pioneer has its loyal fans, and they are innovating, as we'll talk about in our brew session. But before we get to all that, we got to do our flashback. We're going to talk about Scourge of the Skyclaves and how we fared with some of our lists and some other lists that people have been succeeding with. We'll have all that for you after the break.
All right, welcome back. So our card from last week, as Dan mentioned, is Scourge of the Skyclaves. Just a reminder, this is 1 and a black for a demon with kicker, 4 and a black. Its power and toughness are both star. Its power and toughness are each equal to 20 minus the highest life total among players. So it looks at both your life total and your opponent's life total. And whoever has the highest amount, you subtract that from 20, and the difference is its power. If it was kicked, each player loses half their life rounded up. And just a reminder, it does not fly. So we had a bunch of different shells that we proposed and a bunch of different lists 5-0 that were more or less similar to the shells that we proposed. And so I know you guys tried permutations of those. Damon, let's start to you first. You ran a Jund Shadow list that had some success in the Modern Challenge.
Yeah, so David proposed a list that he called Jund Suicide Shadow, and his list don't come with sideboards, and I found a list from they got 5th place in the challenge, just kind of perusing the results. I was like, this is very similar to David's list, but it comes as a full 75 collection that I can just click one button and have an MTGO. And so I took that through a league and promptly wished in many ways that I had taken David's list. The list has a bunch of powerful cards in the sense that it has the Scourge of the Skyclaves, Death Shadow, and then Swift Spears and Bolts. And then it features a bunch of pump spells in the form of Mutagenic Growth, Teamer Battle Range, and Become Immense, along with some Thought Seizes and some Bolts and some Akum Hellhounds. And this is an 18-land Shadow list. And there's a Lurrus in the sideboard, but because of the Street Race in the main deck, you don't have access to it in game one. So I took it through a league, and I went 2-3. And there's a bunch of things about the list I did not like. So first off, the card Blood Moon is just lights out. Lost a match against Red Prowess thanks to that card resolving on turn 3. I looked at my hand, I was like, oh, that is just not going to... This isn't good.
no basic lands in the list is what you're saying.
There's no basic lands in the list. One opponent went to the trouble of resolving a Lean and Arbiter before ghost quartering me, and I was like...
Joke's on you, buddy.
Yeah.
Strip mine was too good.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Path, much less Path Snap Path, is now a really big disaster for this deck. Then there's the whole notion that these Street Raids are just kind of hanging out. They block your Lurrus, and so you go to game two, you're like, do I cut the Street Raids so I have access to Lurrus? I mean, I think I do, because game twos are more grindy. But sometimes you want to cut also your like pump spells, because it might be bad against a bunch of spot removal. And so now you want to sideboard out a lot of cards, and maybe you don't have enough to bring in. That was kind of weird. The green splash for Become Immense or to cast Mutagenic Growth or Veil of Summer in the sideboard was not worth it. We'll get into that when I discuss the next list I tried. But another lesson was Akum Hellhound was a really good turn one play to hit for 4. This puts your Scourge perhaps at a 4-4 at the minimum on turn 2, which is already just a turn 2 4-4, which only gets bigger from there, and puts it namely out of bolt range. On the other hand, I would have draws with a bunch of Hellhounds in them, and the deck plays 18 lands, so the Hellhounds were frequently quite poor, or you go turn one Hellhound, your opponent goes turn two, Renin 6 Downtick, and you are very sad. So a lot of things could go wrong with this card in a deck that isn't really like a dedicated landfall deck.
So did that actually happen, the Renin 6 line? Because I think we talked about that last week, Dave, and you were like, you will just never play Hellhound in a Renin 6 Lava Dart format.
Yeah, I played against both Lava Dart and Renin 6 and saw my Hellhounds die to both those cards.
Oh, the humanity.
So that was replacing the Soulscar Mages, basically.
Yeah. One thing I started learning with this deck is Dan discussed the fact that 10 life is a meaningful breakpoint for Scourge of the Skyclave in the sense that if both players are below 10 life, then it one-shots your opponent. And so this card really sort of stretches your brain in a way that I think takes more than the couple leagues I got under me to really understand how to play optimally around. But you're really trying to figure out a way, how to get my opponent to 10 life or less and then get an unblocked Scourge of the Skyclaves through. How do you orient a game plan around that? And the nice thing is that this leads to some pretty explosive wins on turn 3 or turn 4 a lot of the time. And so between the Death Shadows and the Scourges, this deck has a pretty fast goldfish, which is a nice thing to have in a modern deck.
Turns out Scourge was just copies 5 through 8 of Hidetsugu second right. Just get him to 10. We'll take it from here. So your overall verdict was that not sold on Street Wraiths. It sounds like we don't like the Akum Hellhounds. And the green cards you singled out, Mutagenic Growth, Become Immense. So did you ever cast them, or were they just like hanging out in your hand?
I never drew the Become Immenses, so I just never had a chance to cast them. Mutagenic Growth is barely even a green card. You usually want to lose the life. And so it just felt like I could easily squeeze a basic in there if I cut the green.
Hmm. Yeah, it seems crazy to not take any basics into a list like this. So I would add one basic at least.
Yeah.
But maybe it sounds like you're saying you liked the other builds better, which made some different choices in those slots.
Exactly, yeah. So the next list I tried was a black-red prowess list coming from Gershi out of Modern Challenge. And again, I got to give David some credit for having a pretty similar list proposed. And so this list cuts the green, at least the green mana base. It still plays a couple mutagenic growths. And cuts the street race to just have Lurrus reliably out there. And then it's just a slightly cleaner list. There's way fewer pump spells. There's a couple Apostle's Blessing as this kind of hot new card right now. I've seen in a lot of these lists, one in a Phyrexian white mana. Instant, target artifact or creature you control gains pro artifacts or from the color of your choice until end of turn. And there's a single Agadeem's Awakening to round out the other 17 lands. This list felt much better. I played a league with it. I went 3-2. The very first match was my first time playing against the Belcher list, and I made a couple questionable plays. I didn't really quite know how it worked, or the fact that it could kill me on turn two coming from starting with zero lands. So perhaps if I learned how to play that matchup better, I would have had a chance. And then I played against Tron twice. These players don't understand that Cleansing Wildfire is a thing and they should not be playing Tron. One of them still beat me with turn three Tron. But I made it close. I played against Tron in the final round. I got my revenge with a 2-1 victory. Some Wildfires cleansed some Tron lands. I played against the Scape Shift list and a green forfeit list, I call it green forfeit in my notes. It was a green list that goes turn one Arbor Elf, I go turn one Bolt, and then they concede or scoop or something. I don't know if they were rage quitting or if they, pizza came out of the oven and they just decided they didn't want to play Magic anymore. We'll never know. But it kind of made up for the round one, lost to Belcher, I guess. But this deck just has a lot more consistent design in the sense that there's none of the Street Wraith crap. You don't have to like think about your sideboarding in that sense. No Hellhounds, just a more reliable prowess base. The Apostle's Blessing was cool because some Tron player was like, oh, turn three Tron, I'm going to play a Wyrmcoil Engine and stabilize. And I was like, well, they're at 10 life. I have a Scourge of the Skyclave out. This is a pro artifact getcha line, which I probably screwed up, but then they were still at 10 the next turn, and I managed to do it then. Playing with new cards, at least new cards to me, is always hard.
Yeah, it's wild that Apostle's Blessing gives protection from artifacts.
Yeah, it actually came up a lot in its standard days. And the fact that you can cast it for colorless and the life loss is almost something you sometimes want. It is a way to help get your Death Shadow or Soulscar Mage, or excuse me, Scourge of the Skyclaves bigger. So that's just a really cool card. I thought that was a cool add. I've seen a few people all of a sudden just get people out of nowhere with that card. Did two feel like the right number, Damon?
I would probably go down to one. There was a game I just drew two of them that they were not very good. These shadow lists have basically no card advantage. They rely on basically having the shadow based, I can't really call it a combo finish, but just like a shadow one shot after one for one with some thought seizes and fatal pushes. And so as a result, if you draw the wrong cards in the wrong order, the decks can really, really struggle. They have to go to the Lurrus lines. The Lurrus lines are inherently very slow now. You look at the battlefield like, oh, I play Lurrus next turn. Wait, I can't. That's not how this works anymore. But yeah, so one thing that I really came out of this league wondering about is, do we need to play Scourge and Death Shadow in the same list? So I like Death Shadow a lot more with Street Wraith because otherwise it can come down a little on the slow side. Whereas Scourge is a pretty good turn two play if you've managed to hit your opponent for even a little bit of damage on turn one. Or even if they just fetch shock once or just fetch once, it's at least a 1-1. And then you can grow it from there with a turn three Bolt or something. But meanwhile, Death Shadow loses its best friend in Street Wraith and just didn't seem to be kind of playing at the same cadence as the rest of the deck. The Prowess cards and the Scourge come down swinging much faster. And meanwhile, Scourge only requires you get to 10 life before it's threatening to one-shot, as long as they're at 10 also. Whereas Death Shadow wants you to be playing at a much lower life to be comfortable. And so, for example, the Grixis Shadow lists happily play Stubborn Denials to help protect themselves at low life. Or just like a pile of TBRs or Gore Clan Rampagers or whatever to help push through final damage in a Jund list. And I don't know if we need to do that with Scourge. It felt like that might just not be necessary.
You make an interesting point about pairing the Shadow with like Soulscar, Mage, Swift Spear. Sure, fine, that's aggressive. But playing like, I guess this list has Lava Dart. I've seen Lava Spike in some lists. that chip damage seems like antithetical to what Shadow is all about, right? Shadow, you can just get huge and kill him in one hit.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Whereas Scourge is would love it if you throw a bolt at your opponent's face when they're at 13.
Well, this is maybe not the direction you had in mind, but I saw a 5-0 list from Ocelot 823 that was playing Scourge without Death Shadow, and it was actually a very, very different style of deck. It was like a black-red mid-range where Scourge of the Skyclaves was the cheapest creature, but then it had 3 Kroxas, 3 Seasoned Pyromancers, 3 Phyrexian Obliterators, 4 Liliana of the Veil, 3 Obliterators. Phyrexian Obliterator, what's going on here? It's a crazy collection of cards. You know, it's very deliberate. This is a 6 discard disruption suite. If I'm understanding this right, the Ocelot 823 is saying, okay, yeah, I don't need to be fast necessarily. I just like what Scourge is doing for me. You know, I'll take some damage. I'll eventually chip them down, and then it can just come down starting at what, 3/3, 4/4, and just get bigger from there.
Yeah, I mean, I am not a believer in Phyrexian Obliterator.
Yeah.
Especially in a format where Uro is a lot of places. Like, one of the things Obliterator is supposed to do is ask your opponent to block to stay alive. And then, of course, if you do damage to Obliterator, you start taking a permanence. But Uro almost gains as much damage or as much life as this is even dealing. So I think you're just swinging back and forth, but somehow you're ending up on the way far bad end of that stick.
So I want to keep this Death Shadow question in mind, and I'll add some of my experiences onto the pile of data. Maybe we can revisit that question. So I was thinking about what Damon was saying from his 2 decks that he tried, and I was thinking, okay, well, it is weird to put Death Shadow into aggro, but that was the original form of Death Shadow when it first sort of crept into Modern. It was in a Death Shadow zoo. That deck even had Goblin Guides and just like a bunch of creatures just trying to get in for damage, and Death Shadow just happened to be a cheap, big creature. Made me think like, okay, maybe I should be looking at some more of a burn heavy suite. So I was thinking maybe just like straight up Boros Burn, Splashing Scourge, but I ended up finding a list that Edgar Magayesh tweeted out that he got from Andrew Jessup. These are noted SCG Tour players. And it was playing a few more burn spells in the form of Lava Spikes and even Bump in the Night. This is just like the black Lava Spike. In addition to that, it had the 8 prowess creatures, Soulscar and Monastery Swisspear, 4 Death Shadow, 4 Scourge of the Skyclaves, and then 3 Teemer Battle Rage, 3 Mutagenic Growth. This is a Lurus deck, so no Street Race. It was playing Baubles instead, and then 4 Thoughtseize. So it was an interesting sort of take. I thought, all right, well, maybe this is what I'm looking for, this mix of burn and creatures. So I took this into a league. I went 3-2. All of my wins were against red aggro decks. So maybe this is coloring my perception, because every time you're paired up against, you know, mountains or fiery islets or whatever, you just like can't wait to draw your Death Shadow. That's like the card that makes their entire plan just look very foolish when they're trying as fast to get you down as fast as they can, and then all of a sudden you just have like this 5/5 that becomes lethal the next turn. So getting paired against so many red decks, I was just thrilled to have the Death Shadows. I mean, they were so cheap. That being said, you know, I lost to Bogles, and I lost to a classic Grixis Shadow, where those matchups in particular, I guess especially the Grixis Shadow, I was like, man, these burn spells do nothing, and these mutagenic growths just don't help you at all. They're just like not really worth a card when you can't just like run the opponent over.
Yeah, the mirror actually involves just a ton of math, right? Like, do they even want to kill your creature until it's done a lot of the work for them to bring them under 13 naturally, so it actually costs you resources? And so do you ever want to play Shadow if it can't survive Bolt? But then do you want to get too low if they have multiple bolts in their hand, all of a sudden they're threatening lethal? And yeah, it's just super complicated. So any time you have multiple different variants of Shadow playing each other, I think there's just a weird push and pull where both of you are masochistic, like John Doe from 7 or something. You want the other player to hit you, but not too much. And then when it's like kind of time, then one of you has to go for it.
Yeah. There's also just the basic complications that come up. Namely, you have a Scourge of the Skyclaves down. How big is it? What happens if you bolt your opponent? And you have to just do the math on what is your life versus their life. And the card is just complex. An interesting fact is both players' Scourge will always be the same size. How it compares to Death Shadow does vary, though. Typically larger, but not always.
Yeah, so that Scourge versus Scourge thing came up for me a couple times in the next league I played. So my takeaway from this Bump of the Night Lava Spike configuration was that I just didn't like how narrow those cards were. And I was actually kind of suspicious that Soul Scar Mage was not quite the right card, mainly because it doesn't have haste. So we talked about whether you should swap that off for a Kuma Hellhound or something. And I was like, maybe we're thinking too narrowly about, like, you know, which cards could deal the most damage. Maybe I just need something that's going to deal some damage on turn one, so that even if it dies, you know, on their turn, I've gotten enough to land my Scourge on turn two. So maybe I just want haste creatures. So what if I just go back to the original Death Shadow Zoo and just put straight up Goblin Guides into the deck? So I played four Goblin Guides instead of Soul Scar Mage in my next league. And to go even further, I played two of the Wayward Guide Beast. This is a card that, all right, yeah, I put it in my modern top eight. We'll see. I mean, you know, it's unclear whether this card is playable or not. This is the new Goblin Guide that when it hits them, you have to return a land to your hand. So I put two copies in just so I'd draw it more often and see what happened.
Yeah, really setting up the turn two Scourge with that line.
Exactly. And I decided to go with Street Wraiths with the lures on the sideboard, that exact configuration that Damon was talking about, where you, in the games where you side out the Street Wraiths, you do have lures, but in the game, in game one, you don't have lures. So here I was hoping to see, well, A, whether having the ability to, like, more consistently deal two damage on turn one with these guide creatures, and B, if this would make Mutagenic Growth perform a little bit better. Mutagenic Growth on a Goblin Guide or a Wayward Guide Beast could potentially, you know, you could get something out of that. I put in two Apostle's Blessings as well. So it was like a pretty pump spell heavy deck between two Blessings, three Mutagenic Growth, and two Teemer Battle Rage. This one also went 3-2. I beat Ponza, I beat Red Black Shadow Scourge, I guess we'll call him. And I beat a Jeskai Stoneblade deck. I lost to Banned Spirits, and I lost to another Shadow and Scourge deck. So a couple of these mirrors where, yeah, we were trading off Scourge of the Skyclaves and just trying to see who had the last giant creature standing.
So what is our conclusion here with Scourge? Obviously, lots of people had success with it in a few different shells, and it seems like it's kind of an unsettled question. Not everyone is playing Street Wraith. It's not a card I like at all, especially when we're not taking advantage of Delve effects. You know, Damon didn't like it. It's something that you were kind of interested in, Dan, even though you're still, like, eating up a sideboard slot with your Lurrus. Obviously, the one-drop slot, there's a bunch of different stuff you can put in there. I will never be playing a Coom Hellhound, but I think it's a super high ceiling, low floor kind of card, and those I find very frustrating. Do we want to play four Wayward Guy Beast? There's lots of questions that need to be answered. Or is there even, you know, is it just Tarmogoyf 5 and 6 and some Jund build, maybe? I mean, there's a lot of different ways this card could go.
So I did have an opening hand, David, where I had two Wayward Guide Beasts in my opening hand on the play. I kept the hand just for science. I took screenshots of this. So if you look at the extended show notes, if you're a patron, you get access to our extended show notes. There's photographic proof of this. Turn one, I just played land Guide Beast attack just for science to see what would happen. They did not slaughter pact it, but they did lose. I won that game, so it can be done. You know, the line there is that on turn one, you have to bounce your land. But on turn two, you know, you can get a free, quote-unquote, free attacking with the Guide Beast because you won't have any lands to bounce. And then post-combat, you play the land again and get a second Guide Beast. More seriously, my conclusion is that Scourge is great. I loved the card. I love how it just allows you to play in so much more in the safe zone against other aggro decks. Like, you don't have to be at 7 or 6, you can just be at 12, and it's still huge. I actually love Death Shadow as well, but that might be just because I got paired against probably like 7 aggro decks out of 10, maybe even 8 aggro decks. So it was always just like a huge tempo swing to play Shadow, and I never felt like I needed to enable it. I actually was like always sliding out the Street Wraiths and still losing life just like faster than I even wanted to. So maybe it's a matchup thing, Damon, I don't know.
Yeah, I think I brought up having a Scourge in your sideboard last week against the Shadow matchup, but maybe you consider having Shadow in the sideboard against the Burn matchup or something. Or just maybe it is correct to run the main deck. I mean, I do think that Scourge is here to stay in Modern. The card has already proven itself to me as a viable card. I think we have a lot to learn about it as a community and what the kind of right lists are, like Jund versus Red Black versus Grixis. You know, there's a million variants of Shadow. Possibly they all stay viable and more just a matter of pilot's choice. But Scourge was quite good for me, and I was very happy with what it offered. And it opens up this kind of big black beater in a way that is very different than what Gurmag Angler and Death Shadow are offering, or at least sufficiently different from Death's Shadow that it might push us in the long run into a different direction than a typical Shadowless would go.
Yeah, the other thing that I noticed was that every once in a while, the opponent would not damage themselves. Like, I Thought Seized a player, and their hand had Botanical Sanctum was going to be their turn one land. And I looked at my hand, and it was a Scourge, and I was like, uh-oh, I'm actually not going to be able to play the Scourge on turn two. I'm not going to have any play on turn two, because they were just, like, on Banned Spirits that happened to not shock fetch themselves. So that was kind of awkward, and that actually is one reason why I don't think this is going to hit in Pioneer yet. If it is going to hit in Pioneer, it's got to be in some list that where you're aggressively attacking their life total with haste and with confidence. And I don't think a deck like that exists right now. Modern, I think you can count on them to damage themselves a little bit. And if you can get the Scourge down at 4-4, that would be ideal, so it's out of bolt range. But even playing it on 3-3, I was okay with that.
Yeah. Lightning Helix is a little bit better against it than you would expect, though.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot of situations can come up. Like, I had one turn where I had a Shadow at 3-3 and a Scourge at 3-3, and I was like, if they play a Lightning Helix here, I'm going to lose everything. So, yeah, it's a cool card, and definitely one we're going to be seeing a lot more of. I think it was up to 40 tickets today. It's trending upward, and people are having a lot of fun with this card. I had a great time with it, for sure.
Yeah, I honestly think that if we play for it long enough in Modern, one of these days somebody might kick it.
Oh, man. All right, well, until then, we are going to take a break. And when we come back, we will have our brew session focused all on Omnath, Locus of Creation. Stay with us.
All right, so our card for this week is Omnath, Locus of Creation. A bunch of abilities here. So a red, a green, a white, and a blue for a 4-4 legendary creature elemental. When Omnath enters the battlefield, draw a card, and then it has a sort of cascading series of landfall triggers. When the first land enters the battlefield under your control, you gain 4 life. When the second land enters the battlefield, you get its mana cost back, a red, a green, a white, and a blue. And if it's the third time, then it deals 4 damage to each opponent and each planeswalker you don't control. So Dan, what are some things to note about Omnath?
Yeah, so it's actually a fairly straightforward card. The only tricky thing is just that this landfall ability is slightly different in that it tracks how many times that ability has resolved. So that counter will reset if, for example, you played a second Omnath or if you blinked your Omnath. But apart from that, you just read the card, you play it, you make your land drops, and you get sweet prizes. And if somehow they try to stop you from doing that by killing Omnath, well, you still drew a card. So the dais to removal argument is somewhat put to bed just from the get-go, assuming you can resolve it. Now, in terms of the theory crafting, my favorite part of any card is to figure out, you know, how to really maximize a card and synergize with it and make it let it become its best self. Well, it turns out that when you really get down to it, you don't need to do any of that with Omnath. Obviously, it's a landfall card, so if you're playing Modern, you're going to have fetch lands. You're going to have pretty easy access to the second landfall ability, which is the really explosive one, where you just like this suddenly get all this mana. It's like these 4 Lotus Cobras just materialize out of nowhere, and you've got all this mana all of a sudden. But even if you're not doing that, you're just gaining life at a stunning rate. If you want to play the fetch land on your turn and crack it on their turn, if you just need 8 life, that's a quick way to do that. It just gives you more than the average Magic card does. I mean, in the course of a game, just from having Omnath, you're going to draw a card. You're going to get a bunch of life. You're going to get a bunch of mana, free mana. That's so insanely powerful. And then every once in a while, you might actually deal damage to them and get free card advantage and tempo advantage by picking off their planeswalkers if you can manage to trigger the third landfall ability. But it's basically just like all bonuses. So I don't think you actually need to do anything special with this card. I think it's just an insanely powerful engine. That being said, once you put it into a deck, there's some considerations you have to make that can maybe lead you to some cool synergies. So this card actually had a great opening weekend. It showed up in both Modern and Pioneer. So maybe we will take a look first at sort of how those decks took shape. Damon, tell us about the 4-color Uro Pile.
Yeah, so Uro Pile is an archetype that I guess at the start people were like, well, what do we call this? Uro Pile for now. We'll come up with a better name later on. And then I guess it just became clear it's a pile and it has Uro in it. But now it has Omnath in it. And Omnath just kind of does this thing where the deck used to basically rely on Uro to close some games out, and Uro has a bunch of axes to be attacked even if they're difficult, such as just graveyard effects. Omnath is just a creature, and it wins through combat damage. But in the meantime, it cantrips, and then it just goes nuts on mana, and this deck has outlets to use mana, such as, you know, casting Uros, all the way to Hour of Promise to Seagate Restoration being hard cast. And so the deck is this kind of four-color, you know, pile. But it's a pile of control cards. And so there's some paths, some bolts, some mana leaks, some force negations, cryptics, and then a couple planeswalkers in the form of Renin 6 and Teferi Time Raveler. And then four Uro, three Omnath. And then just a kind of Field of the Dead, four-color mana base to round things out. So this gives it access to a lot of different tools. And Omnath can really stabilize boards in a way that is quite strong. You can go turn five Omnath, you draw a card, then you play a fetch land, sack the fetch land, or maybe you already have an extra land in play. And so you get three land drops in one turn. You use the extra mana from Omnath plus the land from mana from your fifth land to cast Hour of Promise. You go grab a Field of the Dead and something else, or perhaps there's two Field of the Deads, and all of a sudden you just have vomited out a million things onto the board. You're at four more life than you were to start, and you now have two Field of the Deads ready to spew even more zombies if your opponent can stop the first wave. So that's pretty good, as far as I can tell, as far as Magic games go.
Yeah, my read on this deck is that it's kind of just identifying certain cards as being fundamentally broken or too generous, we could say. They just do more than a card should. So it starts with four Uro, then it's got Renin 6, it's got Field of the Dead plus Hour of Promise, it's a Mystic Sanctuary deck. So these are all cards that just have proven themselves in the last few months to just be worth a little bit more than the average card. And then you can just throw Omnath into the mix, and it's saying those are enough to win. Everything else is just sort of like, oh, I just want to have efficient interactions to not die. So you look at the list, it's like a bunch of one ofs and a two ofs of just random interactive cards. Like, okay, there's one Spell Snare, there's one Aether Gust, four Path, one Bolt. Like, it's just like a random pile of stuff, three Force Negation, one Remand, two Cryptic. Like, what is going on here? It's like, well, this isn't a tuned list necessarily, although everyone neck decked and copied the same thing, so it just showed up a bunch of times. But it's like, yeah, these cards are all the most efficient things you can do to not die, plus the most compact self-contained engines.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you just kind of bucketize the cards, it's kind of like four two-mana counterspells, and then it's not too different of a counterspell based on a Blue Moon list that I would have. But yeah, what's interesting is it looks like every single win condition in the deck is from 2019 onwards.
Yeah, and there's some neat stuff synergy-wise. I mean, the three Force Negations, they really shine. You can always pitch your Omnath to a Force Negation if it looks like you don't want to tap out for your Omnath. You could even pitch your Seagate Restoration to a Force Negation. That's like your 29th land. Or if you played the Seagate Restoration and you want to pick it up later, you have Crypt Command that can do that. So there's just like plenty of ways to eventually win and pull ahead. That said, I'm not sure I really believe in the premise of like this particular mix of instants and sorcery speed cards. Like, why play all these sort of tap out three and four mana things when you're also trying to leave up counterspell mana?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the cheaper cards are just to survive to get your Uro engine going.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's matchup specific. I mean, some matchups you just slam Renin 6 turn 2, Teferi turn 3. Some matchups you hold up counterspells on turn 6 or 7, keep hitting your land drops and double spell.
Yeah. So this is a list to keep an eye on. I mean, it did really well in the challenge. It's probably not that prevalent in the leagues because it is over 1,000 tickets on Magic Online. So it's actually very hard to own this deck or even to rent it. But it's out there and it's just strong cards. So we'll set that one aside for a minute. Let's move on to the home that I think, David, you'd identify right away as a natural fit. So Niv-Mizzet Reborn, another deck where you might make use of Omnath. So Damon, do you want to tell us about these lists?
Yeah, so Niv-Mizzet has taken a big hit with the loss of our big fan, big favorite Arkham's Astrolabe. But at least we have a new toy in the form of Omnath. And so I think we've described Niv-Mizzet enough to people over the years now that we don't need to really go too much into depth of what the core shell looks like. But the ones that are seeing the most success seem to be built around Urion and Abundant Growth as a kind of straight replacement for Arkham's Astrolabe. And so you take this list, more or less a fairly proven shell, except for the Abundant Growth swap, and you just toss in a couple Omnaths. and you got a stew going. And there's always been a little bit of room to this kind of room for this sort of effect where it's not a gilded card, and so it's not a Niv hit. But people are playing cards like Kes Dissident Mage, just as a powerful 4-drop that provides a lot of value. So, for example, if your Nivs ever get surgicaled or things like that, you have a pretty good alternate win condition that also generates value. Omnath synergizes even stronger here in the sense that it provides a ton of mana to cast Niv-Mizzet. So a lot of the time you'd cast Niv and then you have a billion cards in hand, but you have to survive to untap to cast them. Omnath gives you enough mana and life that you can probably double spell or triple spell when you cast Niv and then you have a ton of extra mana. Omnath provides all of it but black. And so all of a sudden you can cast Niv and a Lightning Helix and something else that turn. Like a Is It Charm, I guess, or something along those lines. So it seems like a pretty natural fit in this slot. Of course, there is the one Niv tension. Every time you flip over 10 cards and hit an Omnath, you feel a little sad. But maybe every time you play an Omnath, you're so happy and more than makes up for it.
Yeah, I certainly was never a fan of playing the non-gilded cards in Modern Niv. But having seen the archetype really come into its own in Pioneer, those Pioneer flips were often really depressing. Like, they would only hit one or two cards, and they were still good enough. So, you know, maybe I was just, like, addicted to 4-card hits, 5-card hits or something, and it's okay to hedge your bets a little bit, like you're saying, by playing a secondary threat. The mana base certainly already supports it, especially if you're going to go so far as to play Abundant Growth. David, is this kind of what you had in mind when you were just talking about slotting Omnath into Niv?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like Abundant Growth and I don't like Urion, but I do like Omnath as just a cheaper effect that is like Niv Light, if you will. It is just a 4-mana card that replaces itself. If you're playing Utopia Sprawl, you know, you can play it as early as turn 3, and getting to play Niv functionally for free on the following turn or bring to light for free is really nice. I don't know the exact numbers. Obviously, Niv has been like super customizable in a lot of these fractions, but 2 or 3 Omnath just seems like the right number to be in Niv in Pioneer and the right number to be in Modern.
Yeah, I feel like the Niv decks just kind of started leading on Urion during the Companion era and they haven't been able to kick the habit. You know, when you're playing Abundant Growth, you're really all in on Urion. That card is a lot worse than Arkham's Astrolabe. That said, I like Urion a lot better if I'm just getting random bursts of mana off Omnath. I almost want to play more Omnaths just to maximize Urion's, because you're potentially following up Omnath with the fetch land. Yeah, you have all this mana. That's plenty to just get your Urion from the companion zone, cast it immediately, blink your Omnath, draw another card. So that I like. And I also like how Niv-Mizzet, even more so than the 4-color Uro pile, just plays this random smattering of color pips, so that if you do and find yourself with a red, green, white, blue in your mana pool, you could potentially just use all of it. You can use all of it on gold spells. Whereas I think the Uro pile deck probably has to waste more mana more often.
I mean, my concern with all this stuff is that Niv-Mizzet doesn't lose a lot of games where you're getting the 6 and 7 mana, your 6th and 7th land into play. And that's where we're talking about we're getting all this extra value. My concern with Niv-Mizzet is not dying in the first like 3 turns, because we're not doing anything fundamentally unfair. So all these play patterns lead you to have worse turn 1 through 3, but better turn 6, 7, and 8. And I'm just more concerned with the former and not the latter. So that's my reasoning. It might be wrong, but that's where I kind of come down on it. I'd rather play, like, if Omnath is the card for me, I'd rather play 3 Omnath in a 60 card deck than 4 Omnath in an 80 card deck.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's also an important point. Like, the challenge was never like winning after Niv resolves. It's everything that happens before that, especially if you've restricted yourself to playing gold spells, which typically start at 2 mana. So in that sense, you know, even though it would be cool to have Omnath into Niv-Mizzet, you actually don't need both. And you might be restricting yourself too much, or just living in too much Christmas land if you're focusing on having both in play at once.
Well, Omnath provides a lot of life. It doesn't really stop combo decks, so I wonder if we'll see a metagame shift in that way if Omnath dominates. But I mean, if you have a Fable Passage or a fetch land and you're focused on life gain more than a mana advantage, you play Omnath, you play a land, you gain 4 life, you go to their turn, you fetch your land, you get another 4 life, you have a 4-4 blocker. This is a really big slowdown for any sort of aggressive deck.
Yeah, that's true.
I will say a card that I would consider playing is Glittering Wish. This is a card that kind of takes advantage of the Omnath Burst of Mana without having to play Urion, where it functions as a demonic tutor-like effect. But if you have this extra mana from Omnath, then you can kind of get paid off for it. If you have more mana than you have, you know, stuff to do with it, this basically gives you whatever card you need.
Yeah,
I like that. So I'm thinking I want to try like a 60-card version, like you're saying, David, with some of these sinks where Glittering Wish could be that sink as well.
By the way, just as one quick example, I think I was playing one of my Scourge lists against an Omnath pile, and I got them down to like 7 life, and I was like, oh man, if I'd sequenced my TBR like the prior turn, I maybe would have been 1 point off lethal or something, but I was kind of losing, and all of a sudden I blink, and they're at 22 life off Omnath and Uro. Like, what?
Yeah. So that's Modern. Modern, we saw a lot of Omnath four-color piles, and Mordekaiser, probably the top active Niv player right now, did get a 5-0. I know the people in the Niv-Mizzet Discord are very excited about Omnath there. In Pioneer, Niv-Mizzet is a better deck. It's like a tier one meta deck, and the Pioneer Niv list did adopt Omnath in good numbers and did well in the challenges over the weekend as well, so no surprise there. But there's been more explorations with Omnath and Pioneer in some other shells. So David, why don't you tell us about sort of these landfall-esque packages.
Yeah, so Damon mentioned a curiosity that happens a lot. There's a standard deck that seems to be very powerful. Wizards is forced to ban cards, which they've had to do every year since 2017. I think we're approaching, well, we'll see how many cards they ban on Monday, but we'll certainly cross 20, I think. And so if you can do that in standard, and it's too good for standard, Pioneer is basically just like super standard because the most powerful cards have all been printed in the last couple of years, and the extra cards that they printed don't really change anything. So we've seen people try that out, and when we're talking about that, we're talking about the basic shell where they're playing Lotus Cobra to try to get the burst mana, they're playing Uro, the most powerful card in the deck, they're playing Omnath, and then there's a smattering of other cards that have been determined to be too good for standard. So 4 Teferi Time Raveler, 4 Growth Spiral, 4 Genesis Ultimatum, which is a card that people are trying to use in standard to pay off when they have this burst of mana, and then it itself will trigger, you know, possibly more mana from your Omnaths or Uros. Felidar Retreat, that's a card that Damon highlighted during spoiler season as a card he thought would really pay you off for getting a bunch of lands. In general, I think this, and I'm sorry, Dan did mention that one of the ramp payoffs they're trying to take advantage of is Agent of Treachery. In general, I think these decks do struggle in Pioneer, specifically because removal. One of the reasons these ramp decks are so good is that removal is typically pretty bad in standard. There aren't a lot of cards, especially in the mirror, if this is the best deck in standard, that kill both Lotus Cobra and Omnath. In Pioneer, there's actually quite a few cards that can do that, especially after sideboard. And so I think that the fact that black aggro exists, that's a pretty good check. You build a deck that really needs to have your Lotus Cobra or Omnath in play, and those cards are very unique. There aren't replicative effects. So if you play a Cobra on 2 and it dies, your turn 3 play is going to be very, very limited, and you don't have a lot of interaction built into your deck because you're really trying to maximize your permanence to hit with Genesis Ultimatum. So your interaction is basically limited to your Agent of Treacheries, your one Ugin, and you're hoping to get enough permanence in play to live to play those. Well, you don't always just get to 7 mana. That's the thing that happens in standard because that's how Wizards has decided to design the format. But the typical Pioneer game does not just let you dump a bunch of lands into play. So the deck that we have highlighted here only went 3-3 in the challenge, which is not that impressive of a record. Yeah, maybe there's some knobs to tweak, but it is interesting that they kind of had the same idea that Damon was just expressing.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see if this list actually can wind up taking shape in Pioneer. So a couple things I've heard from some pros on Twitter was that when it comes to the standard Omnath mirrors, interaction is not the way to go, because once you start going over the top, you go so far over the top. Killing a Lotus Cobra on turn 2 is fine, but that removal spell against a field of 28-8 zombies off or cats off Felidar Retreat along with an Omnath, and it just doesn't do anything at that point. And so it's more a matter of go explosively exponential nuts faster than your opponent versus try to interact with your opponent. And so I wonder how that theory holds up in Pioneer, where the decks in Pioneer, like Mono Black is fast, but it's not that fast. I mean, I'm not sure what the fastest goldfish from these aggro decks are, but Omnath alone, much less Uro, really puts a roadblock on those. And the deck plays, you know, Grazers, which as always is a pretty good blocker.
Yeah, the only card where you really get ahead by killing it is Lotus Cobra. The rest of the deck, there's not a lot of juicy removal targets. I mean, if you can kill an Omnath, but it's going to cost you a good chunk of mana to do that, unless you're lucky enough to have Revolt on a Fatal Push. But even then, you know, you're down a card on that. They drew a card off Omnath. Meanwhile, the deck has plenty of stuff to do that's not a creature. You know, it has Growth Spirals, it has Cultivates, the Grazers, like Damon mentioned, Teferi Time Raveler to just clean up the mess if someone's trying to scissors you out or something. So, yes, it does have some greedy cards. You know, there's the full four agents, the full four ultimatums. Escape to the Wilds is a five drop. But on the other hand, you know, aggro is not a huge... It's not as much of a percentage of the metagame as it is in Modern, I would say.
I mean, the thing we have to talk about, though, is they're talking about a standard format where you can basically only play two decks. So they're talking a lot about the mirror. There probably aren't a lot of mirror matches with this deck in Pioneer. So that specific sort of philosophy is maybe not that useful.
Yeah, it's just a question of, like, can this deck survive a couple of removal spells, survive until turn four, turn five, at which point it just goes off? Like, the deck plays such high-power cards once you get to a good number of lands in play. So I guess let me put it this way. I would be very interested to play this list in Pioneer and see where it all goes wrong. I mean, as we noticed, the pilot had a 3-3 finish, which is fine, but not outstanding. On the other hand, Omnath is causing something to get banned in Standard, whether it's Omnath itself versus Uro or who knows what. But that's kind of a big mark. We know that Wizards really wants to not ban new cards. This is kind of unprecedented.
I do think that one of the things that I would do if I had to change this list is these cards don't all do the same thing, and the power level changes quite a bit between them. So I'm not sure that expanded 80 cards for your Ryan is the right way to go. I think people get so greedy with this value, like, oh man, I can blink my Agent of Treacheries and Omnath. And I just think, like, if Omnath is the card you want to draw it more often, or Earl is the best card in this deck. So if I want to draw Earl more often or whatever, and just the density of these effects is really limited. There's no card in the deck that performs what Lotus Cobra does. So if Lotus Cobra is an important effect to you and you want to, like, have your either Growth Spiral or Lotus Cobra on turn two, I'd like to maximize that.
Yeah, I think Lotus Cobra is actually the best card in the deck.
So we'll put a link to this deck list in the show notes. I actually just grabbed the deck list from Will Thompson, a great brewer. I used to play against him often in the New England IQ circuit. He's on Team Sunny Days, their sort of up-and-coming brewing squad. But I didn't really look at what his record was. I saw a bunch of finishes with this list. So other people were doing very well with this. So it is like an archetype now in Pioneer. Obviously, people just trying to port the standard build over. But they're having success. There's been multiple 5-0s and other prelim finishes. So it's a real thing, for now, at least. All right, so those are sort of like three case studies, we could say, on how people are using Omnath. What about paths forward with the deck, or other ways to explore it? You can make the case that all of these decks that we talked about, they're just good stuff decks in different ways, and none of them is really trying to get paid off huge for specifically having Omnath in play. I think probably this one with the Genesis Ultimatums and the Agent of Treacheries and the Urien has the most big mana sinks. There's another Wilderness Reclamation style deck in Pioneer that did well over the weekend, where I think, in addition to just being a good stuff deck, I think maybe that deck, again, a standard port, try to take a combo angle of, like, what if I just had all the mana, right? Wilderness Reclamation will give me a ton of mana to just do, like, a big expansion explosion, and Omnath gives me another route to get double mana, while also just being a fine card by itself. So a bunch of people did well with, like, a four-color Reclamation deck, but, you know, it's not, like, a flash counterspell Reclamation deck. It's just sort of like I just want to survive with Anger of the Gods, survive with Mystical Dispute on their Omnath or whatever, and then just go nuts with a giant expansion explosion. So the kind of explosive mana angle of Omnath, I think, is very interesting. I saw McWinsauce playing a Fires of Invention Omnath build. So what do you guys think about all these potential avenues? Do you think that this is destined to just be sort of like a ramp good stuff card, or are there specific synergies that you think might have more brewing space?
I'm going to submit my vote for the Uro pile train. It's just like, it's a little bit too difficult to reliably cast this early enough for it to be focused around a synergy list.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of just like your hybrid Baneslayer plus Muldrifter. It draws a card when it comes into play, so it's not exactly Muldrifter, and
if you get to untap with it, you need a few other cards to turn into something. But it also is very unique, right? The getting four mana from a land drop is not replicative. So it's hard to count on having this card specifically in play. It's a four mana permanent to do it. The main thing, you need it to survive a whole turn. We know that's not going to happen. The drawing a card is the thing that we're always going to get. And that's why it's, I think, started to congregate in these good stuff lists, because the one thing you can count on is the card draw. And so it's a threat they need to kill. Sometimes they won't, and you'll get your extra mana, but most of the time it is just going to die. And you just accumulate a bunch of those 2-for-1s over the course of the game. That's what modern Magic design is, a bunch of those. And eventually your Uro will clean up whatever's left of their carcass.
So in my article, I ranked Omnath as my number one card from Zendikar Rising for Modern, but I said that it was giving me strong Niv-Mizzet vibes in the sense that it just does so much and puts you so far ahead. And it also has aesthetic similarities in its color requirements, that kind of thing. But where it differs, I think the biggest difference is just that Niv-Mizzet makes huge demands of the rest of your deck in terms of, you know, Niv-Mizzet decks. They look very similar because they have to play the same gold cards. Omnath makes no such demands of your deck, right? It's just a generically good card that all it really asks for is land drops. And that's why you just see it surrounded by the best cards in Modern, or, you know, the strongest ramp stuff in Pioneer or whatever. So it's not that you can't synergize with it. It's just that Omnath is so generous that it doesn't require you to. That's my read on it, at least. I think that if you just like banned all those decks out of existence and left Omnath legal, you'd still be finding great homes for Omnath. Even like Elemental Tribal, you know, we haven't even talked about that. That's, you know, it's an elemental creature type that is a deck in Modern. If you really wanted to have Omnath, you have Flamekin Harbinger to go find it. If you're interested in the explosive mana angle, you can just tutor up Omnath with, you know, it doesn't have to be Harbinger. It could be Neoform, Eldritch Evolution, anything like that. I think this is just a really strong creature. So there's a ton of room here to explore. Whether we need to go there is a different question, but I think just for the sake of science, that's what I'm going to be working on this week, seeing if there's any untapped space for Omnath. Any of these decks catch your eyes as something you want to test out before we wrap up?
I'm always a sucker to play Niv-Mizzet decks.
Yeah, I think that's a fine choice. I saw it. A lot of people were interested once again in the sort of Felidar Saheeli package in Niv, because those cards also work great with Omnath. So yeah, there's a ton of things to do with this. We are going to take some of these lists into the queues, and we'll report back next week on what we find.
Sounds good. See you guys on the other side of the color pie.
That brings us to the end of episode 73 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Deck lists from this week's show can be found at our brand new website, faithlessbrewing.com. You can find links to every deck we discussed. You can also find original content, new articles from myself, new brews from David, and more great articles from the Faithless family. Once again, that is faithlessbrewing.com. There is a link in the episode description of your podcast player that will take you right to it. Go check it out now. Have a look while it still has that new website smell. And then let us know what you think. If you would like to support the cast, you can do so via our Patreon, where joining at any tier gets you access to a number of benefits. You get Discord access to come hang out with us throughout the week, talk shop, kick around brews. You also get access to our extended show notes, as well as more benefits at the higher tiers, including early access, custom tokens, playmats, and more. While you're checking out the new website, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, take a moment to give us 5 stars and leave us a friendly review. That's all for this week. Stay safe and happy brewing.